We'll roll out the August 6th, 2011 edition of the Rain Report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, this is the Rain Report. I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY. Radio frequency interference, RFI, has plagued amateur radio for more than half a century. So what's the American Radio Relay League, ARRL Lab, doing to track it, identify it, and eliminate it? Ed Hare, W1RFI, is manager of the ARRL Lab.
How many people here have had a problem with power line noise involving their station? Okay, how many people have a problem right now with power line noise involving their station? So you want to talk to Mike, because we have a program that we work with the FCC to try to resolve these. First step, try to resolve it directly with utility. Well, you'd be surprised, we get calls from people, Ed, I have power line noise. What can you do to help me? I says, well, what have you done so far? Absolutely nothing. So I say, go to our webpage. It talks about working with a utility. Give them a try. And sometimes they'll call, oh, yeah, I called my utility, and they were out in 3 days and fixed it. So they didn't need to call us. So we'd much rather they have worked directly. But when that doesn't work, we then work within this process. The first step is we will then send a letter to the utility describing their requirements under the rules. We provide about an inch worth of free material that tells them everything they need to know to be able to fix this correctly. We offer headquarters staff to them. We will be consultants for free to your utility if you have questions about how to do this. And about half of them actually follow up and do something. The other half just ignore it. Here's information and we'll help you do it is obviously not enough. So we then turn it over to our friend Laura at the FCC. She writes them a letter that, not by coincidence, is worded very much like the letter we send them, only it has an FCC signature at the bottom. That gets a number of them going. It's a slow process. FCC generally will give the utilities 60 days to try to resolve a problem. And if you think about it, with a large utility, the steps of getting through the customer service agent, getting to the correct people to do the troubleshooting, and then scheduling, and of course, all of that can be monkey wrenched very quickly when the hospital across town loses power. As much as it's pain for the amateurs, I can understand where the 60-day window came from. And then, of course, there's follow-up from the FCC. Now, that works pretty well up until the point where the utility has not responded to several FCC inquiries. The next step would involve the FCC turning this over to the field agents for investigation, because they can't take formal enforcement action based only on a complaint. FCC must make a finding of fact. And we've seen that range all over the place. Texas, there was a case where the FCC field agent went out for like an hour and looked at the amateur station and says, well, it's interference, but we don't think it's harmful interference according to the rules. It was 20 dB over S9. We disagreed. We pressed. They actually sent out a different agent who at this point was annoyed. And this guy went off and he identified 87 separate noise sources near that amateur and sent the utility a demand to fix them all. So we're trying to use that as an example to utilities. Why wouldn't you much rather find the three sources that are really bothering one guy than have the FCC come out and maybe do this? So there's been success and failure, sometimes even in the same case. Yeah, we have a Powerline RFI webpage, and on that webpage is a list of power companies, and the list is actually larger now, that have received autographs from either Riley Hollingsworth or Laura Smith or other FCC people trying to resolve the case. Some of these are still failures, pretty bad ones. Some of the cases have dragged on for over 10 years. To me, this is sheer nonsense. These utilities often spend orders of magnitude more money not fixing power line noise than it would have taken to fix it. Some of these utilities have received multiple letters, all involving their chief executive officer and their legal staff. What we're finding is that these utilities are generally not competent to find power line noise. But there are consultants that we can point them to that they can hire that can go off and do this for a few thousand dollars, but that's got to be less expensive than tap dancing around with FCC for 10 or more years. We had one case down south that had dragged on for 7 years. Mike Gruber went down to a convention there. He's giving a talk about power line noise, and out of the audience, the hand raises and says, hi, Mike, I'm so-and-so. I'm your complainant from 15 miles away. And Mike looked down at all the equipment he'd brought with him, and he looked at this guy, and he thought of spending Sunday at the league booth, not exactly fun doing booth duty. He says, how would you like me to come out to your house tomorrow and we'll track down the power line noise? So I go, yeah. He was pretty happy. So Mike did. Now Mike gets to the guy's driveway. He unpacks the equipment. He says, well, I'm going to show the guy how this works. He turns it on, and out of the speaker comes this horrible burn. And Mike looks at the meter, and he starts pointing it around, and he points it up at the pole right outside the guy's house. Burn. That was it. He was done. Mike had spent 1 minute diagnosing a problem that the power company had tap-danced around for 7 years. The point we make is don't ever give up. The thing about power line noise, of course, there may be some things that the amateur can do. There's the distinct relationship between the level of noise you'll receive and the distance your antenna is from the power line. So if you have your antenna located 3 feet from those overhead power lines, there's a number of reasons to change that, but one of those which, of course, is interference. So if you, for example, could put up that 120-foot tower, get your antenna up well away from the power lines, you'll probably have much less power line noise. And we work an awful lot, too, with industry committees, because I think that it's important that amateur radio be seen as not existing in a vacuum. I mean, we're not separate from technology. We love technology. We're hams. We love to tinker with it. And amateur radio needs to stay connected to the rest of radio technology. Contact with industry is one important way to do this. I serve on a number of IEEE industry committees, often in the position of elected leadership, because we're going to bring to that table hard work, sound expertise, factual evidence, and a realistic outlook. And as a result, I mean, I serve on the IEEE's EMC Society Standards Board as its elected secretary. It's a voting position. I serve on the ANSI C63 EMC committee up until recently finished my second term as chair on its immunity committee. So we work pretty heavily with the big boys because it's important that ARRL help maintain a seat for amateur radio at these tables. We'll work with individual companies as well. In fact, a lot of them are pleased to work with us, various standards committees as well. Now, as you can see, I clean up pretty well. In fact, a lot of these, of course, they know me well by now. I can show up in business casual, but where needed, I'll put on the suit and tie and do what I can to represent amateur radio. Here's an example of where some of that work is leading, because we talked about power line noise earlier and the fact that utilities need information. Well, it dawned on me one day that ARRL has prepared a tremendous amount of information for utilities to use. Well, why don't we work through our contacts with the IEEE to get all of this turned into a recommended practice? So what we did is we took all of that stuff and we ported it over into the template that IEEE uses for a recommended practice. We're in the process right now of forming a working group. I'm going to expect within a year or two this will be a recommended practice within the IEEE, talking about those steps that a utility should take from the time the complaint line rings to the time when they can hear the complaint and say, my interference is gone. And now the FCC letters could say to a utility, well, we have a complaint of interference. Please check it out. If this is caused by your equipment, please resolve it in accordance with IEEE recommended practice, name the number. And I think that that could be a pretty powerful tool to help these utilities move things along. Conductors don't need to be carrying power to generate radio noise. For example, you have cross braces on a lot of the old wooden poles. If up where they're joined together, they're on either firmly bound together or separated. If there's a loose bolt up there, that's in a strong electric and magnetic field that'll induce currents into those metal pieces, and you'll get sparking happening right inside the connection. So a lot of things can cause power line noise. We also work on a number of other committees as well. And this shows up there with the IEEE Standards Board. If you look right in the middle, Secretary, there's Ed Hare. So we've managed to keep a seat for amateur radio at those very important tables. Now, this has had a lot of effect. HomePlug, for example, is an industry standard for in-premise broadband over power line. We worked with them 10 years ago. We did some joint testing together, and as a result of that testing, they decided that their product was not going to use the amateur bands. So there's the 75 and 80 meter band, there's the 40 meter band, there's the 30 meter band. In fact, that work is carried over now to a recent BPL standard developed by Senelec that's going to be accepted probably internationally. And in Annex A of that is a list of the amateur spectrum, the shortwave spectrum, and CB spectrum, or a broadcast spectrum, with a mandate that that shall not be used. So we've seen a lot of this really panning off in some really good work in international standards.
You're listening to our third and final excerpt from a 2011 Dayton Hamvention talk by Ed Hare, W1RFI, the manager of the ARRL lab in Newington, Connecticut. We'll conclude Ed's talk in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available as a weekly podcast and download from therainreport.com.
One of the noisy devices that's out there right now, apparently, that is causing some interference, notably on the West Coast, is a series of 1,000 to 3,000-watt lighting controllers. Apparently, they're being used primarily in California at this time for some form of indoor gardening. Yeah. Well, you know, we're not too sure what they're growing in some cases, but, well, we have a consultant out there who's a West Coast guy who apparently... He speaks the same language as some of these farmers, and there was a case out there that involved about S9++ noise, and Jerry went over and contacted the farmer. Apparently, they had a social moment together of some sort, and he convinced the farmer that, look, ARL is not looking to try to bust an individual homeowner. We want to try to get some information. So this farmer very kindly sent us the controller for testing. We ran it through the test, and we found this thing operating at about 30 dB over the FCC limits. This was audible from over a mile away. One of the points that we were able to make to this individual farmer and others is that although certain state laws may have changed with respect to whatever gardening they're doing, federal law has not changed. And although FCC agents, if they come out, they'd be looking for interference, we don't know exactly what intra-agency agreements or interagency agreements they may have with other departments of the United States government. So we'd like to give you some information that'll help you resolve this. And of course, in this case, we're going to have to go back to the manufacturer. We had to return this to the farmer. That was the deal. I kept it. So now we're going to go buy one on the open market and initiate a formal complaint, because 30 dB over the limits means that that one device is making as much noise as 1,000 legal devices. You know, this device complies with FCC limits, does not exist. Apparently, they feel that the purpose is not necessarily in compliance with federal limits either. So the radio noise, felony, what's the balance there? I'm not too sure. So, and these are just a few examples of some of the league's work with industry. We also do a lot of work for the DC offices. And I'm about to say it, the B word, broadband over power line is still with us. We're not done with this yet, primarily for a couple reasons. This is a horribly bad precedent for amateur radio. S9 plus 15 dB, 24 hours a day, over entire ham bands, and build it as big as an entire state, is just something that's not going to work from an RFI perspective. It's still an open rulemaking. We still have this before the FCC. We took them to court. We won on a couple of points. There are systems still being installed. In fact, I received a report just last week involving a BPL system in rural Virginia. Apparently 12 and 10 meters is getting absolutely creamed. Utility has just completely ignored him, so I might be taking another trip down to Virginia. It's different than other devices. I mean, it emits most of the time. It's a large area, and it has a significantly different interference potential. Now, I liked an analogy that some ham gave me, because frankly, I think broadband over power line is technologically flawed. And the reason I say that is, okay, we have computers we use over Ethernet wiring. Now, take your Ethernet wiring, untwist it. Separate the wires by about 10 feet. Strip off all the insulation. Put them outdoors in the rain, 30 feet in the air. And now connect them to all sorts of other wires and noisy devices. They'll work just as well, right? Well, of course not. That's exactly what they're trying to do with broadband over power line. The bottom line is with BPL or even potentially some of these other devices, you know, if this is using locally used spectrum, there will be interference, there's no doubt. And I'm glad to see that where the FCC has dropped that ball, some of the international regulators have not. Some other countries apparently are a little bit more realistic about what to do. And yeah, they're going to allow broadband over power line. They've put a lot of serious constraints on it, and the notching for the amateur and other bands, simply not using that spectrum. I've seen notching work. I went down to Houston, Texas. They put notching in place where they stopped using the amateur bands. I parked a mobile station under an overhead BPL coupler, could not hear the broadband over power line noise in the amateur bands. So we know that if they do not use the amateur spectrum and their filtering is adequate, it can be an extremely successful model. And of course, the FCC somehow sees spectrum a little differently than we do. And now this is a quick example of one of the studies we did. Is I used IonCap to look at worldwide communications capability on amateur radio. And interestingly enough, it told me something I never knew before. Did you know on 14 megahertz with 100 watts and a Yagi, you can communicate all around the world? Well, and this is what it shows you. I programmed into the program the existing median values of man-made noise, and this is what it showed me for circuit reliability on 20 meters at some time a day. I then programmed a level of noise equal to the legal limits for broadband over power line emissions. And that band went from a worldwide band to one of very, very limited geographical coverage. And even then, any stations you heard were going to be noisy. So this is stuff that we've provided to the FCC in our filings. Because it's a carrier current device, it needs to meet the limits for intentional emitters below 30 megahertz. CISPR 22, it's a real mess because CISPR 22 has provisions in it for BPL. The BPL industry claims CISPR 22 doesn't apply to BPL because it's not specifically mentioned, even though it's in one of the tables. They tried to work with CISPR to get them to change the standard. They could never get consensus, so they now moved it over to Senelec, where it apparently has taken on some new ground. But what they're doing, I looked at the standard only a couple of days ago. It's looking pretty good from what I can see. But smart grids, it's the buzziest of the buzzwords. And right now, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, developing more intelligence for the power grid is an important thing to do. There's a lot of positive benefits that can come out of some of the work that's going on in smart grid right now. They're looking at trying to do things like automatic meter reading completely remotely. That's good. They're also looking at hoping that that can be tied in with some user applications that would let them control some of the electronics in your home. You could control it or let them control it so that you would then dry your clothes at 2 a.m. instead of when the rates are high. It could be even better. Some of the work they're doing with hybrid and electric vehicles could actually use those batteries as a big rolling storage, where some people who have that vehicle as a third car could agree with the utility, yeah, we'll put it on, and this will be programmed to charge my battery at 2 a.m. when rates are low. And then at the middle of the afternoon, when rates are real high, I will sell you back that power at a profit. You can then take it back out of my battery, and I think that there's some people that are going to do that. Those who have solar panels, if they have excess storage capacity available at 2 p.m. from their battery bank, when they could recharge that at 1/10 the price at 2 a.m, they might be willing to sell it to the utility company. So what these sort of things could do is they could reduce the peak demand on these lines. So now when they put in that new housing development, instead of having to rebuild 20 miles a line, the lines are now going to have a peak that's operating below its max capacity, so they might not have to do that. Most of the smart grid stuff right now is operating on the 900 megahertz band. There are some amateurs on that band. From what we're seeing, we're suspecting that they're not using the weak signal part of the band, but you know, there's other things happening with amateur radio on the band where there potentially could be some interference problems. We're working on one or two cases in California. Other amateurs have reported that their noise levels on HF are increasing as the smart meters are going in. We're still looking at that. If that's the case, we know they're not using HF spectrum. None of them, to my knowledge, are using BPL right now, except for in the few BPL systems, that's a possibility. They might do some broadband over power line inside the house, but that'll probably be done using the home plug spec. Amateur bands won't be involved. So it's either noisy power supplies in the meters or a misassociation of cause and effect. We've seen it often where amateurs will say, okay, smart grid's going in my house. I turn on my radio. There's noise that was not there 6 months ago, the last time I turned on my radio, so it must be the smart grid. Well, it might be, but it might also be the new noise source that's present in the neighborhood or even sometimes within your own home. So we're going to look closely at this. We have that consultant out in California who, in addition to speaking the language of farmers, is pretty good with EMC. He's working on a couple of cases for us out there as well.
This concludes our third and final excerpt from a 2011 Dayton Hamvention Talk by Ed Hare, W1RFI, manager of the American Radio Relay League, ARRL Lab. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2011 RAIN, all rights reserved. Now, for everybody connected with RAIN, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from all of us at RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.